ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to A Big Country. I'm David Claughton, and it's lovely to have your company as we join reporters exploring regional Australia. This week, we're meeting a delegation of international chefs who've gathered in a small town in rural Western Australia. They're visiting the country to learn more about our lamb and how to use it in culinary dishes. It's all part of efforts to get Aussie-grown lamb on more plates around the world. We'll meet a couple who've spent more than four decades on the land, not only farming, but also transforming the landscape through an extensive tree planting program. And we'll hear about one family's mission to educate consumers about where their flowers come from. With her brother and sister growing flowers on the family farm in Tasmania, when Beck Thomas decided on a career change from her corporate job, she joined the flower industry to promote locally grown blooms. That's coming up. First today, to a record-breaking effort. A team of five shearers in southern New South Wales have set a new record for the most merino lambs shorn over 8 hours with five stands. Reporter Emily Doak was in the shed watching the record attempt.
It's no ordinary day in the shearing shed at Morven, south of Wagga Wagga. The five shearers, Lockie Robertson, Benjamin Duncan, Cameron Hicks, Toby Walker and Nick Lehman, are working at a frantic pace, aiming to set a world record. Toby says he's been training for months.
It's been about 6-7 months of long days of shearing, drive home, smash the gym for an hour and a half, diet, gear preparation. It's been a really long build-up. It's glad to be over, to be honest.
People might have seen shearing in a shed during the day. Just how different is it in a world record attempt conditions?
As intense as it gets. Today, that's my first experience. It's so mentally straining. I didn't realise how focused I had to be, and that was just all day. So dialed in and focused on what we're doing.
Good to be shearing with these other blokes alongside you.
Great bunch of guys, like they were awesome. Everybody pulled through with a mammoth effort today, and it gave me a lot of strength to look around and see the other guys just not backing down an inch all day.
It's not just the shearers that need to prepare. Wool grower James Finlay is supplying the merino lambs and says making sure there's a nice, even run has been a challenge in the dry-up conditions.
We went through about sort of 5,000, 5,500, and we've drafted that down to 2,650. Ready for today for the five boys.
And that's because, you know, they've got to be a fairly even lot and they've all got to meet certain criteria in terms of size, weight, wool cut, that sort of thing. Huge logistical challenge.
Yeah, it's always a bit stressful when you've got to make sure they average a kilo over everything that's only, yeah, about 3 months old. So when Lockie approached us a few months ago and asked us if we could do this, do the record here, I was a little bit apprehensive with the way the season was going. It was pretty tough. Fed. We had everything in containment here till sort of July. So they were well fed. And then, it started to rain and we let them out on the grass and we've had a really good lambing. And we've been pretty fortunate this year. The lambs have actually been really quite even.
The World Sheep Shearing Record Society governs attempts like this across Australia, New Zealand, the UK and South Africa. Eight judges are on hand today and convener Johnny Fraser says this makes sure everyone is on a level playing field.
So the lambs had to be 1 kilo of wool, they had to cut 1 kilo of wool each. So these did 1.4, which is well over the mark, which is good. So that was a start. And then after that, we're looking mainly out the back. The sheep go down the porthole and we count at every half an hour. And we have four judges down there, two on each stand. And we are looking at any cuts or any roughness, stitch jobs that they've done and all that. And if there's any more than six sheep that are badly cut, after the seventh one, the record will stop.
So you've obviously seen a lot of records set, challenged, beaten over the time. Yep. How does this one rate here in the Riverina of New South Wales?
To be honest, with this merino record, we never really had a five-stand record before. And these guys aren't your show shearers. These guys are just good old shed shearers that I rate this as probably one of the better ones I've been to.
In this high-pressure environment, there's no time for error, and each wriggling sheep can cost valuable seconds. After the first two-hour run, the shearers look exhausted. Smoko, though, is a time to look after the body, as Toby's mum, Sania Worquet, explains.
The ice bath is a rapid reduction of skin temperature, which also reduces the lactic acid build-up, especially in the legs.
But we've got no fancy plunge pools here. We've got a good old-fashioned bush ice bath. How's it work?
Yes, we have an esky. out the back, and we did have to shop long and hard because a couple of these boys have got pretty long legs.
It's the final run. Hundreds of people are in the crowd cheering the shearers on. The final tally, 2,301. Cameron Hicks has been eyeing off a world record for years, so he's happy to have his name in the books.
Glad to see the end of it, but I'm pretty stoked in my efforts today.
Big drain on your body. What do you do to recover?
So we'll stay hydrated, a lot of stretching and stuff, and just, yeah, monitor things. Can't get too crazy and go out and have too many beers, otherwise, yeah, you end up in a bit of trouble.
And I'll tell you what, you Kiwis set a cracking pace, tracking this record as a team of five, but is there much competition between the stands for this special record attempt?
Funny enough, there was two Kiwis in the team and they both led the charge, so yeah.
We just won't mention that to the Aussies.
Yeah, no, we've been living over here long enough that we've been adopted by you lot.
Also from New Zealand, Benjamin Duncan was a late call-up, so he didn't have as much time to prepare, but he had the highest tally of 502.
I'm probably a bit old to be doing this sort of stuff.
You're obviously match fit though. I think you might have been lucky. Close to the top.
I think I got lucky today. Must have been the pressure.
Your first run, pretty good, but then you just built on that throughout the day. Was that something mentally that happened, or did you just get in your groove?
Yeah, I sort of wanted to play possum for the first half of the day.
Let Cam think he had a win.
Yeah. And then just drag them back.
Nick Lehmans from Dimboola in Victoria.
So you've just finished the 8 hours. You're clearly exhausted. Did you have a figure in your head that you wanted to shear?
Not really. I'm just trying to, try and get a flow and stick with it. And try and push through the pain.
And it's hard, obviously. What's hurting at the moment?
Pretty well everything.
The event also raised tens of thousands of dollars for charity. And Riverina shearing contractor Lockie Robertson says it's been tough, but worth it.
Pretty sore standing here. My back's on fire and I reckon I've torn my hamstring or something, to be honest.
Yeah. Tough day in the shed or a good day in the shed?
I didn't quite hit the 400, which I wanted to, but I was pretty close, so happy with the overall team effort, to be honest, in some sheep that probably weren't what we thought they were going to be. Just not getting a cut. The sheep, had a bit more dirt in them, and we were changing a cutter every, I don't even know, 8 or 9 minutes. So that was slowing us down and took a bit more pushing than we thought.
You reckon it'll be easier to recruit a few Riverina young blokes to be shearers after putting on this spectacle for them today?
Yeah, I reckon there's a few young fellas running around just wanting to have a chat, little kids and stuff, thinking it's all pretty cool, so that's good.
This is Freshwater Creek, which doesn't really flow anymore, but the whole length of Freshwater Creek has been vegetated right down to the 90 Mile Beach where it ends. So we started it, but it's been taken up, which is really good.
That's Fergus Irving, a wool producer from Woodside on Victoria's southeastern coast. We've jumped in the ute to check out the property where Fergus and his wife Rosemary have farmed since 1980. Ms. Irving says after moving to the farm, they soon realised something was missing.
Well, there weren't any trees and we're running sheep, and sheep need shelter. So we started planting windbreaks, and we belonged to a local land care group. They had a day on farm planning. And we employed he was a landscape architect, and he came and helped us draw up a plan so as we could do it aesthetically as well as being useful. So that was the start.
The start, specifically, of a multi-decade mission to fill their farm with native trees. Step one was to collect seeds. That was Mr. Irving's job, and he had a pretty unconventional approach.
I had a veterinary practice at the time, so I drove around the district and I'd be aware of what trees were fruiting and flowering. And we had bags to put dead animals in, so I'd stop the car and pick seeds along the roadside from fruiting trees. And we tried to get a good variety, but the backbone of our windbreaks were Melaleuca ericifolia, the local tea tree, Coast Manigum, Viminalis. Basically, that was probably it. Oh, we'd have apple box and a smattering of all the other local trees. And most of it came from the roadside, although I knew where every patch of remnant vegetation was in the district. The Port Albert Racecourse the Gifford Rifle Range Reserve and various other little spots where there were good stands of indigenous trees.
To plant these trees, Mr Irving turned to direct seeding.
There was a local group, the Gippsland Tree Seeders, who built a direct seeder before they were really commercially available. And we used to mix the tree seed with chicken crumbles. The tree seeder had a disc on the front and a seed box like an ordinary pasture sowing seeder. And we'd just go along and we could plant kilometres and kilometres in a day. First of all, we'd use herbicide to flatten the pasture and then just direct seed. And I remember one day with one of my boys, we spent half a day and probably planted 15 linear kilometres of tree seeds. Mm. And they grew very well that particular day, or that particular sowing period.
Mr Irving says planting indigenous trees just makes sense.
I want to recreate, up to a point, the landscape that was here. And also, I presume that the local fauna probably prefers to be on local flora.
So you're coming up to 40 years of this regeneration project. So how has the farm changed and transformed over those decades?
When we bought the farm, there were very few trees on any farms in Woodside. And now most of the farms have got trees, but it's made a huge difference to this place. We have, I think we've just about sown enough trees, but all along our gullies we have colossal numbers of birds. We've got some species we're not so keen on, like rabbits. We do have the kangaroos, wombats, echidnas, koalas. We're looking after the local fauna, which gives us a lot of pleasure.
Rosemary and Fergus Irving, wool producers from Woodside on Victoria's southeast coast, ending that report from Faith Tabaluyan. Before that, Emily Doak took us to the wool shed for a record-breaking shearing effort, and you can see more of Emily's story on the ABC website at abc.net.au. I'm David Claughton with you for A Big Country. Still to come, we'll meet the chefs who've travelled from around the globe to learn about cooking with lamb, and we're meeting a family working in the flour industry. With more than half the cut flowers sold in Australia imported and no country of origin labelling required, it's tricky for consumers to know where their flowers come from. A Brisbane woman decided something needed to be done so consumers could make informed decisions about what blooms they buy, and she had just the right connections to do it. Pip Courtney has the story.
3 years ago, Beck Thomas called time on her 20-year corporate career, bought a van, leased a shop and became a flower seller. Her mates were baffled, but Beck was on a mission. When buying cut flowers, she wants us to ask, were they flown or grown?
I wanted to educate people. I wanted people to be aware of where their flowers are coming from, and I wanted them to get to know their farmer. I wanted them to know Rob grew these.
The issue is personal. The reason is on her wall. Beck's brother Rob grows flowers. Rob and sister Pip, she's also on the wall, run one of the biggest oriental lily-growing businesses in Australia. Several days a week, flowers from the family farm at Flowerdale, where Beck grew up in northwest Tasmania, arrive in Brisbane.
They're pretty much picked, they're cooled, they're packed, put on the boat overnight, and a cool truck meets the boat the next morning and then zooms up the coast, and then I go and grab the flowers and then we bring them to market.
As well as lilies, Rob and Pip send tulips, delphiniums, stocks, snapdragons, sweet william and status. There are also flowers grown by several other Tasmanian growers. She wants to start conversations about the downsides of imported flowers, starting with how long they last. Sister Pip says growers want the same transparency for country of origin labelling like we have for food.
You don't know how that's been treated prior to us getting it. Who's picked the product? How old is that person? Where have they come from? How it's chemically been treated? The residues on the plants? You know, all that sort of stuff.
Do you think many people have bought flowers thinking they're Australian and they're actually from overseas?
Absolutely.
Beck's career change came after learning about the impact rising flower imports were having here, especially on rose growers.
There's a lot of imported roses that come all the way from, you know, Colombia, Ecuador, Kenya, 12,000 kilometres away. And some of these growers actually went under. As much as Rob said, what are you doing? Can you not find something a little bit easier? But I just had this burning desire to make a difference because I knew I was actually in a position to be able to do that.
Flowerdale is known for its productive volcanic soil. Growing up, there were plenty of farm jobs for the four Sadler kids as their parents added flowers to milking 700 cows and growing potatoes. Jan and John's diversification into carnations in 1982 surprised many.
There was no ag department that could tell us how to grow flowers because nobody grew flowers.
The dairy cows went, new flower varieties were added, and more polytunnels went up. At their peak, there were 86 growing tunnels, and the couple were shipping to most capital cities. Did you ever think that you would have a business this big that could employ three of your children?
No. And about 30 other people.
In 2014, the next generation consolidated the business by importing a greenhouse from the Netherlands. It covers 2 hectares.
Everything is climate controlled, all the fans, the air exchange, everything is done by an algorithm. It'll predict what the weather's going to do. It's very clever. It's been a big investment. For us, it's an insurance policy. It's allowed us to go all year round and to grow really good product that's really consistent, because the consistency is the key.
The 800,000 lily bulbs in here will produce about 4 million stems a year. Bulbs are planted every week. The Sadlers used to grow in their own productive soil, but problems controlling nematodes forced a move to hydroponics. Rob and Pip have seen the impact imports are having in Australia. As they've grown, others have got out.
In the past, there might have been 30 growers. Now there's maybe 5 to 8 major growers that have all invested in technology. They've all got fairly sophisticated setups. I guess that's the future of agriculture as well, to continue to invest to get the efficiencies.
Rob and Pip are proud of sister Beck and her advocacy for the industry, while Beck's proud of the business her siblings have developed. Jan and John Sadler are proud of all three. And while they know many have tried, they hope Beck's message gets through and people start asking, grown or flown?
I make Korean style bulgogi. Yes, it's like Gangnam style. Yeah, you know Gangnam style. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah.
A global experience in Western Australia's Great Southern Region.
Ozram, it's an awesome land.
Recently, 16 chefs, known as Lambassadors, travelled from around the world to the small town of Borden, 380 kilometres southeast of Perth, to cook for local farmers, all bringing their unique flavours and showcasing locally grown lamb.
What I'm preparing is we grilled the barbecued lamb neck, beautiful lamb neck from Australia. Then we will be served the onion soup. Wow. Yeah, something because our team from the Vietnam, USA, Japan. So we'll try to put something together on the dish.
So what you mean by that is you're trying to bring your own little flair to Australian lamb?
Yes, of course, you know, because every country using Australian a different way. Japanese, they have the Japanese way, Chinese have Chinese way. That was why I tried to align all the flavours and, you know, together on the one dish.
Clinton Xu owns his own cooking school in Shanghai, China, and was one of the many culinary professionals who volunteered their time to come to our country with Meat and Livestock Australia to learn about the red meat supply chain.
So I have the culinary school in Shanghai. So we was educate, you know, for 100 and 100 young chefs every year. So I think it's very important let a young chef and the people to know about quality of the Australian lamb. It's not only about the lamb, it's about this country, the people. So I think this is important why I'm here.
Is this your music?
Yeah.
Where are you from?
From Saudi Arabia.
Chefs travelled to Western Australia from 11 different countries, and you could really hear it in all the different music and the languages that were being used. Lindsay Noto travelled all the way from America to join this year's delegation, which was the largest group the Lambassador program has ever seen.
It's 27 flight hours and 5 different airplanes that it took me to get here. I lost an entire day to get here, and it was worth every minute. There's a huge opportunity where I'm from in the South, in Alabama. You know, barbecue meat is such a prevalent thing in our cuisines, but lamb is very, there's not a lot of knowledge around it and experience. And so my hope was that I could come here, learn more, and then bring that knowledge and information and new techniques from these other chefs back to the States.
Obviously, there's a lot going on in the geopolitical world at the moment. How do you think that's impacting, you know, what you're able to cook with over there?
Well, I think it's really interesting. You know, the primary difference that I've noticed between, you know, Australian producers and the processing facilities is the focus on the ecosystem and sustainability and the emphasis on the product and the quality all the way down to the eating experience for the guests. And that's a huge, there's a huge disconnect. I think, no shade to the States, obviously being an American, but you know, it's all about the carcass, right? And what they eat, and then it kind of stops there. And I think that there's such a huge trickle down effect when it comes to the focus on the ecosystem and being fully sustainable that this country puts an emphasis on that we don't as much in the States.
How are you going with the flies today?
Funny, many fly. Yeah, but okay, so okay. And hot, yeah.
Over the next couple of weeks, the chefs will tour the country with Meat and Livestock Australia, which this year received $3 million from the federal government's Live Export Transition Package. Kazu Mitsuhashi founded the program 10 years ago in Japan.
Because in Japan, initially, there's no sheep meat eating habit in Japan, only except up in Hokkaido for skiing area. That's only the culture in Japan. So,
would that be because a lot of, you know, international people visit there for skiing?
Yeah, it is very popular, especially from Australian people.
Yeah.
Yeah, very famous Niseko and then the stuff. But there is a Genghis Khan, it's called, special Japanese sheep meat in Japan. But other mainlands, it's nobody eat lamb for really, really small, tiny consumption in Japan. There's no domestic lamb in Japan, very, very tiny. So a majority of the sheep meat in Japan is 70% Australian lamb, and New Zealand is basically the rest of it.
How has it grown in the last few years, though, since you've started this program?
It's getting popular now these days, because one of the reasons is just people is making more global and then looking for something new.
While in Borden, the chefs went head-to-head in a friendly cook-off and then served up their dishes for producers who were in town for the WAMCO AGM.
I just had the neck chop something, made with a neck. It tastes like a bit of miso, a bit of onion. It was pretty good.
David Mears is a mixed farmer near Broome Hill in the Great Southern, and he says programs like Lambassador are good for the industry, but with the market shifting, farmers like him have had to adapt.
Not as big as what we have been, of course. Yeah, our numbers have decreased a bit due to the sheep market and the way it's gone. But look, sheep aren't really the big focus on our farm. I guess canola growing has taken over a bit, but sheep are certainly still a good addition to the diversification of what farms need to be.
Did you vote?
Yes.
Which one did you vote?
The noisy mob.
The chefs will now continue their journey across Australia. And while all of them came from such diverse backgrounds and different cultures, one thing stood out in every conversation I had with them: their genuine passion for understanding the story behind what Australian farmers do best.
We cannot judge just the meat. We need to know the backstory about the product. When we come here in a beautiful landscape, and the very important is the beautiful people behind the industry.
It's a good, oh my gosh.
And I can't taste any flies.
Good, thank goodness. The Aussie flies are just as good as the Aussie lamb.
Reporter Kate Forrester brought us that story from a recent lamb cook-off in the small town of Borden in Western Australia's Great Southern region. You can read more on Kate's story about the international chefs touring Australia as part of the campaign to promote locally grown lamb. You'll find it on the ABC website, abc.net.au. And that's the show for today. I'm David Claughton. I'll catch up with you again next week with more great stories from regional Australia. I'll chat to you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.